Hello, I'm Josh Fennett, and this is the big interview on Monocle 24. My guest today is Alejandro Aravena, a Chilean architect and the director of this year's Venice Architecture Biennale. Having scooped this year's Pritzker Prize, the equivalent of a Nobel in the field of architecture, it's no exaggeration to call today's guest and his studio Elemental among the most important to be working in the field today. Having grown up in Augusto Pinochet's authoritarian Chile of the 1980s, the young Aravena didn't take to architecture immediately. Rather, after a stint running a bar, he honed his much-admired style over decades of work, drawing extensively on the consultations and participation of people, politicians, and developers for whom he received commissions. Aravena's work, as he puts it, is often to retrieve the correct answer to a poorly posed question. And answer he has. Today, Aravena's work offers a high-minded meditation on the opportunity and problems inherent in rapid urbanization, providing social housing, and building sustainably. And I'm delighted to say that the Santiago-born architect joins me here in Venice. We're looking out over the beautiful red-tiled roofs of Venice, maybe the apogee of your career to date. The Pritzker Prize this year, we also have the Venice Architecture Biennale. But I'd like you to cast your mind back to when you were at school and tell me the first inklings that you had that you might even want to study architecture.
I've been asked this question many times and still don't have an answer. I guess at 17, what can you possibly know about what you prefer or what you don't? And then Chile in the 80s, the last years of the Pinochet's dictatorship, was not particularly an open moment where you were full of opportunities and alternatives. It was a quite narrow set of alternatives of what to study. So I guess it was clear that it was not medicine, not engineering, not journalism. So I guess the kind of thing, okay, what are you good at? Drawing, physics, mathematics? Well, try architecture. I had no idea what architecture was. No any relative in my family connected to architecture. So I guess it was a good thing thinking backwards, because I had no preconception of what architecture could be. And it was a really open field. What I do remember, though, is that there was an amount of knowledge, an amount of matters that I need to swallow. I still remember those years of this thinking that you're entering something relevant, something that has layers and layers of knowledge accumulated. Yeah, I guess that only if you're young, you're doing the crazy things that is required to go into a new field, like trying to swallow that body of knowledge and measuring and drawing. And then it was a strange time of life, but I remember it with a great pleasure.
Looking at your work, there's a tremendous social engagement. There's a level of thinking about the reciprocity of how these buildings work that arguably is not in other people's way of looking at architecture. But you haven't always been so positive about it. And I'd like you to put to death the rumour that you actually became so disillusioned that you, after architecture school, went off and started a bar instead of becoming an architect. Is that correct?
Yes, but I was not disappointed by architecture, but some clients that were using architecture just as a way to make some private profit. I guess you don't go and spend huge amount of time and energy and emotion in trying to learn from buildings that have been there for thousands of years, then to deal with somebody that has such a narrow approach to the built environment that is only looking for a private profit. In the end, what you're trying to build is some public common good. My reaction, maybe because I was too young and immature, and the kind of tantrum approach, okay, if I'm not going to be able to do something relevant here, I prefer to do nothing. That's why I disappeared mainly and opened the bar. Because architecture, the thing is that for good and for bad, it lasts quite a long time. So if you make a mistake, it's going to be there for generations, and you can ruin the life of people for generations. So since I didn't feel I have the capacity to make a contribution to the built environment, I prefer to be as harmless as possible and going into this other thing. Of course, then I was I kind of felt that I had to give architecture a second opportunity and try to go back to architecture with maybe the worst comeback ever. I was still living at night, you know, in a bar, you go to sleep at 10 a.m. and wake up at 5 p.m. The kind of people that you meet is completely different. Maybe none of the people I was talking have ever finished even high school, but there's a different kind of wisdom and knowledge that it was valuable in any case. But I heard of a competition in the university where I studied. It was for a church, and even though I'm agnostic, I thought, well, maybe this is an interesting second chance. I submitted the proposal. I still think it was an interesting design, and was disqualified because of the wrong paper. So it was so embarrassing. And then I was given the real opportunity of my life by a former professor of mine, Fernando Perez, who was the dean of the school, and they were looking for an architect for the mathematics school. So I went from nothing to an institutional building. And of course, when you're given such an opportunity, you grab it with nails and teeth. And I was practically living on the construction site, trying to make the best out of this incredible opportunity I felt I was being given.
And you've obviously got a tremendous amount of humility. I mean, feeling that you owe the built environment something, and if you're not going to do it perfectly, you shouldn't do it at all. I wonder if I'm maybe opening up Pandora's box here, but, you know, what are the main challenges you see architecture is facing? Not all of them, but what are the main ones? And do you think architects should be piping up as part of the public discourse about these problems, say, of urbanism, say, of social housing? What are the key things for you that you think need to be addressed today?
Okay, I would name one, which is inequalities. What we've witnessed, particularly where I'm coming from, it is clear if there's any, there may be the only agreement we see in Chile, that the discussion is much polarized between left and right and this and that, but there's only one agreement, which is that we have an embarrassing issue with inequalities that is expressed in cities in a rather brutal way. It's not an abstract thing coming from a paper. And every single day you experience the inequalities of people that live far away in places that have no opportunities. You have to go from the third world in the morning to the first world to do something, study, work, even have fun, and then you go back to the third world at night, and you spend huge amount of time doing it in a very bad way. So it's a very violent experience, of inequalities. But that is now not exclusive, I would say, to the developing countries. Who would have thought that the developed world is facing the same kind of thing? The events that we have witnessed lately, the social pressure that is accumulating in peripheries, where nevertheless all basic needs are satisfied, yet the feeling of that population is that they do not belong to the same society. And that anger, resentment that has been... I'm not saying that this was created by the city, but it's experienced in a very concrete way in the city. This, I guess, also for developed countries, it's becoming a big issue. And the city may be a way not to dismantle this kind of social ticking time bomb, but a way to channel the forces in a more positive way. I mean, in the end, changes in cities do not happen under normal circumstances. You need crisis. I mean, a natural catastrophe or a social crisis. And what we've been witnessing, even though it might be a cliche, all the crisis that we've been witnessing, maybe it's an opportunity to use the same city that is accumulating that social political pressure as a way to improve people's quality of life through the built environment. Other professions may contribute to the inequalities or quality of life through their own knowledge. Politicians will do their job, economists will do their jobs, businessmen will do their job. We have to do that as well as designers, as architects, and engage that conversation with what we know to do best, which is to give form to the places where people live.
Do you think everyone agrees with you? I mean, there is a tremendous amount of architecture out there, which is private commissions, which is put up to draw in tourists, not made for these social reasons that you're advocating, not interventionist in the way that you're calling for people to address inequality. But I wonder, your Pritzker Prize this year, much deserved and a great honour, I'm sure. Does that represent a sea change in the way that architects are not people that make amorphous, shimmering buildings to tout a tourist trade around the world, but maybe that people should be thinking more clearly about it? Are you out there on your own, or are other people starting to feel like there should be an intervention?
Well, I would say that the Biennale is the proof that there's a lot of people trying to engage these kind of challenges through very concrete experiences. Of course, there's the need to change the discourse to change the questions, to dive into new questions that the world is full with. But then for these new questions, raising awareness or making diagnosis, it's necessary but not enough. What do we propose to deal with these issues? And the attempt of the Biennale was try to share that knowledge, try to share more tools, but sometimes even more enthusiasm. I mean, the fact that you're not alone in that. I mean, it is very hard. It takes a lot of time, energy, effort, to be able to improve the conditions, to go beyond business as usual, to go beyond the private gain into the common good. So I guess that you need those tools and more clues so that you go out of an exhibition like this with more tools in your pocket, but also enthusiasm that you're not alone in that effort. And it's our responsibility as architects to see in these challenges a field to test our capacities, to translate the forces at play into very concrete examples for how to improve people's quality of life.
So we'll come back to the Biennale, we'll bring ourselves back up to date in a few moments, but your career really hasn't been spent curating and assembling other people's experiences for the public. Your career has been spent building buildings that make a difference for people. So I wonder if we can delve into some of those projects. Why don't we start, I think it's roughly 12 years ago in northern Chile, where you were given a project which very much sums up what the problem that cities are facing today. How can you build enough good quality houses for people and make them feel like they're kind of part of it? Can you tell us a little bit about this project and how you think social housing could be approached in future?
You're talking about the Iquique Quinta Monroy project in the north of Chile. And the first thing that is important to understand is that we accepted to work within the rules of the policy and of the market that were there. Of course, you can choose and say, well, this is not fair. I mean, this won't create a decent built environment, and choose to just complain about it or try to change the rules. In the meantime, in a relatively small country and relatively poor country like Chile, 100,000 subsidies were going to build anyhow. So our approach was, okay, within the set of rules, let's try to put more brains, more than bricks, into this problem and try to make a better use of the scarce resources. So we started from the constraints, and the constraints were a public policy, property-oriented. By that I mean that as soon as you're eligible for a subsidy, you become the owner of the house, meaning the housing policy is the biggest transfer of public money into a family asset that a family will ever receive in their life. And we wanted to make that new asset to be not just a shelter against the environment, but a tool to overcome poverty. In any case, the set of constraints was a $7,500 subsidy with which you have to buy the land, build the infrastructure, and build the house. In the best of the cases, with a rather efficient building industry, we could deliver between 30-35 square meters. That was a fact. It was not a choice. Evidence showed that a middle-class family, but more than numbers, more than the technical data, the exercise of yourself imagining living there or not, that was the ultimate way to test if the designs were acceptable or not, allowed you to build this 30-something square meters. A middle-class family lives reasonably well in around 80. So when there's not enough money, market and policy were doing two things: reducing and displacing. Reducing the size of the house, looking at the house as if it was a small, tiny unit, placing it where land costs nothing in huge underserved peripheries that is a disaster for a family that came to cities in the first place looking for opportunities. You come to the city and you're segregated from the opportunities that you were looking for, jobs, education, health, even recreation. So starting from that, the only thing that we did was, okay, if available money only allows you to build from 35 to 40 square meters in the best of the cases, why don't we look at them instead of as if they are a small house, as half of a good one, given the evidence showed that a middle-class family could live reasonably well in 80. Actually, when going to the peripheries and we were measuring the process of expansion of the social housing units that were given by the state, kind of stopped around 80 square meters. And that could happen thanks to the design or despite the design. So the only thing we did was reframe the problem as 40 square meters, not as a small house, but as half of a good one, and allow design to channel people's own resources, capacities, needs, and desire to go from the social housing initial stage to the middle class standard that we thought social housing should have as a horizon. So our whole point was try to make people's capacity and need and desire to achieve that middle class standard to be done in a safe, cheap, and fast way.
And it's a very powerful project that's a hallmark of the kind of very clever work that you've been doing. You've been quoted in the past as saying design is kind of at its most powerful when things are done simply. And you've described sustainability in the past as a rigorous use of common sense, which I think is absolutely brilliant. But do you think every problem that faces the built environment and the city can be reduced or can be reorientated if the right question is posed?
Yes. I mean, the more complex the problem, the more the need for synthesis. And this is the trick. You're not reducing the complexity of the problem. What you're trying is to simplify the answer. You have to keep intact the complexity of the question. We spend a lot of time designing the question. There's nothing worse than answering, well, the wrong question. So to understand what is the real need and what are the desires, and this is the thing, this is not about just needs. Of course, they have to be taken care of and is maybe the starting point, but they're necessary but not enough. The desires are a big driver in people's life. Actually, when I said that architecture is nothing but giving form to the places where people live, if you double click on each of these words, places, I mean, the range and the variety of places that we have to give form to, it's huge. No wonder it's so difficult to produce quality in the built environment. So what informs the form of these places, I mean, the kind of forces at play come from very different realms, eventually pulling in opposite directions. But if you even double click on the word life, it ranges from needs to desires. And this is the kind of dimensions that architecture should be able to synthesize in a built form. From needs to desires, from the individual to the collective, from the ordinary to the extraordinary, every day to hopefully the most sophisticated and intangible dimensions of human civilization. And I guess that's why it takes time, it takes a lot of effort, and the more complex the problem, we're required to come up with answers that are able to channel the forces at play in a rather simple way, which doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It may be simple, but not easy.
So one project which I think has really captured people's imagination around the world for the good that architecture can do, for the positive way that these questions can be framed, and actually the positive upshot for what happens, came in the wake of a natural disaster. A tsunami hit your country. There was an area of floodplain that was completely destroyed, people's houses completely displaced. And we heard a very familiar refrain from people in the business industry about building a $42 million concrete wall so that sea will never come in again. You thought very differently about this project, and I believe you were only given 100 days to do so, to work out. I'd love you to talk us through how you went about framing the question for how to rebuild this area for the people in a thoughtful way that was able to increase their quality of life, and also maybe question how we normally go about solving these problems of natural disasters, of architecture, of just investing money in things that maybe aren't for all of our good. Tell us about Constitution.
Well, I guess this is a very concrete example. What do I mean by synthesis? Of course, when you have a city destroyed by 80%, is the kind of moments where you would not want to miss the window of opportunity that you were given. Cities do not change radically under normal circumstances. But even though it's a cliche, maybe this was a moment where we had to change things that maybe have been unable to be tackled under normal circumstances. So for that, we ask people. We started the same way in social housing. We knew that given people will build the house on their own, let's have them as part of the discussion from day one. In addition, because we were given only 100 days, it's clear that within that period of time, you won't be able to do everything. You will have to rely on people to keep on adding to whatever your point was. So we started the participatory process mainly to understand what was the problem, not to give the pen to the families and draw and expect from them a solution. The issue was mainly to understand what was the problem. And it was very important because what was floating in the air as a question was, how do we protect this city against future tsunamis? Alternative one, prevent installation on ground zero, $30 million mainly in land expropriation. This is exactly what was and it's still being discussed in Japan after the tsunami in 2011. And if you have a disciplined population like the Japanese, you may have the people respect the prohibition of construction on ground zero.
But you think in Chile people would move into that area immediately, they'd inhabit it in spite of
not
the regulations?
Not for a second will they listen to such an instruction. It will be occupied illegally, and that will be even more dangerous. So it was politically and technically irresponsible. Nevertheless, was an alternative. Alternative two, the one that you mentioned, for $42 million, a big wall, big infrastructure lobbied conveniently by the big building industry because it meant huge contracts, no land expropriation, so politically preferred. But then Japan, in 2011, proved that trying to resist the force of nature is useless. This is not big waves. We're talking a mass of water moving at 800 kilometers an hour. That's why eventually the first part of the mass of water may be rejected by such a heavy infrastructure. The rest of the mass will go on top on that big infrastructure and go into the city with even more speed and force. So we thought that, well, let's ask people, before in jumping into a third alternative, let's make sure that we're answering the right question. And when we asked people, they said, there was a lady in this, we built a physical place in the main square where public deliberations were taking place. And that old lady said, you know what, I've been living in Constitución for 50 years, I've never had a tsunami in my life. So maybe the next one is going to happen in what, 30, 40 years? But every single year, she said, we have the problem of the city collapsing due to the flooding of the rain. There's no proper system for channeling the water of the rain into the river. So the city collapses.
So this is the question again, isn't it? It comes back to the idea that, you know, there needs to be some sort of sea defense, sure, but that's not on the tip of everyone's tongue when there are social problems as well.
Not only flood to the rain, they even mentioned public space, which in this city, we may be less poor, but we can't enjoy life because the quality of public space, it's really bad. Cities are measured for what you can do in them for free. London, in that sense, maybe is one of the most incredible places. There's 44 square meters per inhabitant of parks. In Constitución, there were two. So people were complaining about no quality of life due to the bad quality of public space. And finally, the question of identity. If you rebuild fast, then you may threaten the quality of the built environment, the buildings that fell. And people said, you know what? It's a pity that the old buildings, adobe buildings, were destroyed. But the identity of the city is not the houses. It's the river. So whatever you do, make sure that we have democratic access to the river that until that moment was privately owned. So you understood that the question had at least four dimensions and not one. Against that, we proposed a geographical answer. If the threat comes from nature, against geographical threats, provide geographical answers. A forest that instead of resisting, dissipates the energy of the tsunami. At a cost of 48 $6 million. So if you're measuring just one thing, protect the city against tsunami, it was by far the most expensive alternative and the kind of thing they say, yeah, you architects come here and are just an extra cost to us. I mean, you come up with this strange things. But since we made this participatory process, we understood that if we just provide an answer to the tsunami, you may have spent $42 million and then you have the population rioting and complaining because that was not the question they were expecting to be answered by the state and the market. So by understanding that the problem had at least four dimensions, what we did was a survey in the public investment system and found out that there were four different ministries with projects in the exact same place, not knowing of the existence of the other projects, the sum of them, $52 million.
And I love your quote that cooperation is the scarcest resource in cities. It was the fact that these people weren't able to coordinate for a public good, that there appeared to be no funds. Do you think, just moving away from this slightly, that that's often the case in a lot of cities? Do you think there's a lack of joined up thinking about how we can actually make a number of good things happen from a single decision or a single way of developing things?
Absolutely. And the reason for that is not just because people are bad or they're stupid. I mean, the institutional architecture of states tends to be by sectors. So a ministry is building houses, another ministry is building roads, the other one is building the schools. So if you have a shortage in infrastructure or in housing or in hospitals or in schools, operating by sectors is rather efficient. You get a lot of coverage in a rather quick and short period of time. But the second generation of questions is not by sectors, it cuts across. That's why to make any significant project in a city will require to have at least four or five ministries sitting on the table. And that's why the scarcest resource is not money, but coordination. And their architecture, I guess, can offer at least one tool, which is that capacity of synthesizing. This is what I meant. When you, in one single project, try to respond to four and not just one thing at a time, we were able to save $4 million. And this is, in the end, the way you get things done. I mean, forget about convincing a politician or a big building company. If money, in the end, is saved, maybe that's the only way to move things ahead. And I think this is a very important part of the discussion ahead. The way capital will engage or not in the kind of challenges that we have ahead. Impatient capital that is just looking for private profit, for sure, is not going to be able to tackle any relevant issues that we are facing, not even in the built environment, as a society. So I guess that the approach will be to look for patient capital that on the long term is looking for predictability more than profitability, because only that way we will be able to engage relevant conversations for living together as a society.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Josh Fennett. My thanks to Alejandro Aravena for joining me today on site at the Venice Architecture Biennale. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Luty and researched by Gaia Lutz. You can always listen again or brush up on our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. Until next time, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.